From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, we're bringing you unexpected connections in music.
Latin America is all about groove, whether it's cumbia, or whether it's samba, or whether it's baile funky.
Gogol Bordello's lead singer tells us about his surprising passion, and Latinos with a passion for the environment.
People come over here to dump polka, even stolen cars.
One man struggled to literally clean up an L.A. neighborhood. Also, we're checking back in with the STEM sisters, learning about organic farming in Puerto Rico, and so much more. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week, goodbye 2013 and hello 2014. Now, we wish we could tell you that everything is going to be okay in 2014, but when it comes to stories about how immigrants get to El Norte, unfortunately, we can't. Most of the times, these migrants are so traumatized by the experience that they don't want to talk about it. And that's where groundbreaking and fearless journalists like Oscar Martinez come in. In 2009, Martinez embarked on what is now recognized as one of the most dangerous journeys on earth, from Central America to the United States of America. It's a journey that more than 25,000 migrants make every year, and the statistics are harrowing. Amnesty International estimates that in the last 6 years, as many as 70,000 undocumented immigrants went missing in Mexico. Martinez wrote dispatches at every step of the journey. Now they're collected in his book, The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging Narcos on the Migrant Trail. He joins us from station KQED in San Francisco. And welcome to Latino USA, Oscar.
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So your book actually was published first in Spanish, and the title of the book was Los Migrantes Que No Importan. Why do you believe that Central American migrants are the migrants that don't matter?
Okay, the political class of Mexico have any interest on that migrant, and that have a lot of reasons. It's a population who don't vote, who never denounce, and it's a population who travel. They don't know Mexico. It's not the Mexico of the big cities. It's little towns where the Mexican government renounced their job and the organized crime take that place.
Central American migrants are the fastest growing migrant group into the United States. But when you would talk with them, even though they knew that there was this potential for losing everything, their life, getting raped, they were still making the decision to go para el norte. Why?
Well, I think it's think that there is something better in the life than the life that those people have in Central America. And I think that this is one of the greatest motors in the history of the humanity.
In the trips that they make to El Norte, these people have to use tremendous amount of smarts in order to make it all the way to El Norte. You know, do I stay? Do I go? Do I tell them who I really am? Is it a trap? How did the people that you met along the way handle these kind of decisions?
It's a chess game. The road is a chess game. If you made a bad movement, you can get into the hands of Los Zetas. And this road leaves you a big trauma, a big scar in your brain. In 2009, 64% of Central American women who crossed Huixtla suffer some abuse, including sexual harassment. So what happened with that population? Who is asking them? Who is giving support to that people? Anybody? They just came to United States or are deported to Central America and continue with their lives. But what kind of love you can have after experiment one of that experience?
And part of that experience comes from what you call the wolves and the sheep on the trail north. So who are the wolves?
In 2007, the incursion of Los Zetas changed the sign of that migration, because that wolves are very cruel wolves, and are wolves that make massive kidnap, that sell a lot of women in the north and in the south, brothels. And of course, the incursion of Los Zetas with the participation of some authorities, mainly the local authorities, the municipal police or the state police. And that incursion changed the name of the wolf. And the name of the wolf right now, it's Los Zetas.
And you write that you believe that there are no repercussions for the wolves, for the Zetas. So if there is absolute impunity for the Zetas, is there any hope that somehow this dynamic is going to change?
The work of the journalism who is put light in the dark corners of our societies make more difficult for the corrupt, for the haraganes, for the estados perezosos y gobiernos perezosos, as the Salvadorian, Honduran, Guatemalan government, who never hide his voice to ask Mexico what happened with all their women who is being raped in Mexico, what happened with all his men's, childs, and ancient who are kidnapping for Los Zetas all days. And I think that el periodismo, and that's what I'm going to say in Spanish, is like el mar cuando orada una piedra. El mar tarda años en horadar una piedra. Y no es el ritmo que nos gustaría, pero es el único que tenemos.
So what do you want the people who read your book in English, who may not have a lot of contact with Central American migrants that they know of? You know, you feel very, there's a lot of anger, there's desperation that I felt reading your book. But what do you want your audience to learn from your book and do with that information?
I hope to provoke anger. I think that anger is a most powerful motor. It's very difficult to go and sleep with anger.
Make your reader so angry that they can't sleep.
That do something. I don't know what an engineer can do about that topic. I don't know what an architect can do reading that book. But I pretend to generate the feel que impida que esta persona se quede quieta.
Oscar Martinez, thank you so much for all of your work, for risking your life, for being an amazing journalist, and for telling these stories. Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you for your respect. Muchas gracias. And I hope that a lot of people can read the beast, mostly people who can speak Spanish.
Oscar Martinez is a reporter for ElFaro.net and the author of The Beast, Riding and Dodging Narcos on the Migrant Trail. Years ago, KBBF in California was the first radio station in the country to hit the airwaves in both English and Spanish. Back then, that was pretty unheard of, and there was doubt about whether the station would succeed. But KBBF is now celebrating 4 decades on the air. Martina Castro of KALW in San Francisco went to see how this tiny radio station came to be.
The show Caminos Indígenas, or Indigenous Paths, kicks off with this song, La Canción Mixteca. It's an old Mexican folk song from Oaxaca about a deep sense of homesickness.
Muchísimas gracias, auditorio de KBBF. Mi nombre es Lorenzo Oropesa, como todos los
That's show host Lorenzo Oropesa. He mixes music with information about education and health. As he hosts, He switches fluidly between Spanish and
Radio KBBF, FM,
Mixteco, an indigenous Oaxacan language. Lorenzo is still learning how to run the board. He's just a volunteer here.
He actually works for California Rural Legal Assistance as a field worker. He's out there with the campesinos every day. He knows what the life is like. My name's Josue Lopez, and I'm the program director and the board treasurer of KBBF.
Josue says KBBF was built by volunteers like Lorenzo Oropesa. Forty years ago, those volunteers were basically kids.
They call themselves the pioneros, los pioneros, the pioneers, because that's what they were, really. But these people were in their teens.
At the time, the Chicano movement was highlighting the needs of recent immigrants and U.S.-born Mexican-Americans.
Basically, it was a way of recognizing that we, as a group, had a cultural identity that we could grab onto.
Los Pioneros had their work cut out for them. They had no money, and their audience was mostly Spanish-speaking farm workers. But the founders were savvy, says board member Dave Yanda. They found grant money and a way to attract listeners.
One of the stories that one of the founders told us was that they bought little transistor radios, and they went around the neighborhoods and gave every family one of those, mm-hmm. and literally created their listenership.
And the station aired programs that spoke to those listeners.
Desde Radio Pacífica, esto es Democracy Now!
Radio Bilingüe presenta Línea Abierta.
Now, 40 years later, KBBF is still holding true to its original mission, to serve a varied group of Latinos, from those born and brought up here to those just arriving. Here are some listeners at a recent fundraiser.
You really get to listen to the voice of the community and just have an alternative voice that reflects my own reality. And it's something that I can share with my family. And it's something that's a part of me and who I am and where I come from.
It's given me important information about immigration, how the government works, and they support us as we try to get legal papers. I'm really grateful. It's like a school for me.
It allows people that are English speakers and Spanish speakers to share with each other what each culture has to share.
The station has its supporters, but it also has its challenges, namely a discovery in 2008 that the leadership was mismanaging its finances. The station lost its federal funding. Since then, KBBF has gotten new leadership, and the members of the board are promising honest and open governance. Financially, KBBF is still struggling, but it's also still on the air. And Josue Lopez isn't too shy to ask for volunteers.
Well, thank you. Is there anything that you didn't get to say that you'd like to say?
I have an opening for a programmer.
Well, it never hurts to ask. For Latino USA, I'm Martina Castro in Santa Rosa.
And thanks to Jasmine Lopez for her help with that story. Coming up on Latino USA, I'll be talking with our favorite science-minded Latinas, the women with STEM degrees, coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Back in September, we introduced you to four young Latinas we call the STEM sisters. Now, they're not really sisters. They're friends who met at DePaul University in Chicago, where they majored in environmental studies. Now, there's a lot of talk out there about how being a STEM graduate can lead to all kinds of wonderful opportunities. So we're following the STEM sisters as they make their way in the world as STEM graduates. When we met them at the end of the school year, they were just beginning to look for work. So before the year is over, we wanted to check in and see how they're doing in the real world. Three of the four STEM sisters joined us from WBEZ in Chicago, though you might notice that one of them was running just a little bit late. And back with us in the studios are the STEM sisters. Yay!
Yay!
So we have Xochitl. How
Hi.
Are you, Xochitl?
I'm very good.
And we call you the vegan farmer. I'm sorry. We just got... And then we have Sonia, Hello. Also with us in the studio in Chicago. And we call you, Sonia, the meat eater.
The carnivore.
The carnivore.
So, Xochitl, the last time we spoke, you had moved down to Tennessee.
Yes.
And you decided that you and your partner were going to be working on a farm. Tell us how it's been going for you.
So the reason why I decided to go to Tennessee and leave Chicago was to pretty much put in practice the things that I learned about urban agriculture. Well, when I got there, it's really different. I definitely didn't do enough research about the soil there. And we did start a little just flower garden. And it's just a lot of living that peaceful life that I kind of was mostly what I really wanted, was just a peaceful life surrounded by nature, pretty much surrounded by beauty.
So basically you weren't able to make enough money to survive on the farming?
No, no.
Was that a big letdown for you?
It was kind of, yeah, but just I don't feel kind of so much let down as I feel like, okay, well, this didn't work out, but I gave it a try. So actually, I'm really excited to try something new, you know?
What's been going on for you, Sonia? You?
Yeah, so I started working at a park district, and it was at a marsh area, and it was a venture educator with kids. I just enjoyed being there with the kids, and they're just always so excited and enthused. It was great. But I was telling Sochi that during the winter time, there's not that many programs available, so it kind of just slows down until the spring. But I did start working as a tutor, working with my old high school, tutoring them, especially with math and science, which is what the school is struggling with.
That sounds so wonderful, Sonia. It's like full circle, right? I mean, going back to your high school. But I want to know a little bit about the nuts and bolts. Like, how did that job come about?
I applied, I interviewed, they asked me how my math was and my science, so... I mean, because of my degree, I was familiar and I was okay at it.
Were they, when you said, look, I have a degree from DePaul University in environmental, were they just like, oh, wow, that's really, what was their reaction?
Yeah, they were very surprised. They're like, really, that's awesome, environmental. And I'm like, yeah. They're like, you don't see that often. I'm like, yeah, I know. It's not a very common degree. They were like, so they were more intrigued on what it was. They were just like, environment, so what do you do? And they just wanted to know what that degree consisted of, what an environmental science degree is. It's not something that they're very familiar with. And once I told them, yeah. And also it helped that I had that experience at the park district because I already had experience working with children and communicating with them. So that also helped.
So did we get joined by Marcela?
Yes, I'm here.
So you guys, can you help us come up with a super cool nickname for Marcela?
Oh, okay.
So Xochitl, the vegan farmer, Sonia, the meat eater, yes. Marcela, the...
Marcelo, what would you like your nickname to be?
I can just be the vegetarian, I guess.
Well, we need another one because isn't Alma also a vegetarian?
Yeah, Alma's a vegetarian.
Is she like la flaca, la chaparra, la...
Both.
Right?
Pick one.
Pick one, Marcela.
I don't know. You guys can call me...
La chaparra.
Yeah.
And we're also joined by Marcela La Chaparra. Welcome. We interviewed recently some Latinos who are working within the tech sector to get more Latinos involved in tech careers. And one of the things that they said that was really important was having a mentor. So I'm wondering, do you guys have mentors? And how are they fitting into kind of what comes next for the STEM sisters?
All right. This is Sonia. I don't have any mentors, unfortunately. I wish I did. I think it would facilitate things a little more because I mean, we're kind of just doing this, making things up as we go. We don't really have too much knowledge of what we're doing, being, I mean, first generation here and our parents not knowing how things work either.
Xochitl, what about you? Mentors? Have you had one? Do you want one?
I do not have a mentor. I would really like one because the same situation that Sonia is in, and, you know, I can only speak for myself, but maybe Marcel is in also. We really need, you know, someone, especially within our fields, you know, get to know somebody, maybe have a conversation with somebody who's been kind of in the situation that we've been in. We're really interested and passionate about helping people. So I think we do need mentors, and we also kind of practice being mentors in our everyday lives.
Marcela, do you have a mentor?
No, I don't have a mentor.
What's your big dream for 2014? Xochitl, let's start with you.
Okay, my big dream for 2014 is to get a solid job teaching, which is something that I really want to do. So just kind of getting my foot in the door of the field, wherever pretty much. I'm open right now to travel wherever, you know, the wind wants me to go.
Alaska, Hawaii, watch.
Anywhere.
Sonia, what about you? What's your big dream for 2014?
Well, now that you mentioned Alaska, no, I'm kidding. I would love to go to Alaska, but who knows? I don't know. I'm entering the year pretty hopeful. I have so many plans, and like Xochitl and I were speaking, we're at a point where we have nothing holding us back. We don't have any real big responsibilities, no mortgage, loans, family. So I'm really hopeful to just pick up and go wherever. I was telling Xochitl that I was considering the Peace Corps, and that would be a great opportunity for me to travel and leave the States at the same time, help other people.
Marcela, what about for you? What about 2014?
To start off, I really want to get like a job in ecological restoration. I'm just so eager to, you know, like get out there and getting my hands dirty and with nature. And I don't know, maybe moving to California. It's just a thought right now. I don't have like any.
¿Y tus papás qué dicen?
As I have not mentioned to them.
Híjoles. Oh boy, they're going to find out about the. Okay, Marcela, ¿te vas a California? No, mijita. Well, to Xochitl, Sonia, Marcela, and to our missing STEM sister, Alma, all of us at Latino USA say thank you so much and feliz año nuevo and have a great new year. And we'll talk to you in 2014.
All right. Yeah, we're looking forward to that.
Same to you.
Stay tuned, queridos. We'll continue to visit with the STEM sisters in 2014 as they make their way in the working world. And if you have any questions for the STEM sisters, hit us up on Facebook or on Twitter. We are at Latino USA. Remember when you first heard about organic farm food? It was out of the box, hard to find, and expensive. Now, organic farming is common here on the mainland, but in Puerto Rico, it's just starting to catch on. Although the island has rich soil, most of the farms disappeared over the last half century, and now the island imports the vast majority of its food. But as Marlon Bishop reports, a small but passionate group of young Boricua farmers is trying to change that.
Have you ever had your coffee brewed by the very same person who grew the beans? This is the first time that's ever happened to me.
Café Turegua, which is grown with 100% organic practices.
This is great. This is delicious.
Miguel Sastre sells his homegrown coffee at a farmer's market in San Juan, Puerto Rico. There's all kinds of people here. Old hippies, young people with tattoos, packs of toddlers running amok. There's also a few dozen young farmers selling their produce. They're part of Puerto Rico's new eco-farming movement.
So yeah, let's walk around and I'll show you a little bit.
28-year-old Daniela Rodriguez runs a farm up in the mountains. This is one of the places where the movement started.
This is our seed starting area. Different types of greens, which is pretty much our specialty.
We're near the little town of Ay Bonito, which translates as, oh, how pretty. And it is so beautiful up here. The perky rows of vegetables, the densely forested mountains beyond. Even the air is fresh and crisp. But as idyllic as it is,
did I ever think I'd be running an organic farm? Absolutely not.
For Daniela, farming is a kind of accident. It all began with her mom, Silka Besosa, a corporate executive who decided she'd had enough.
So she moved to the countryside and she started a farm, and all her friends told her she was crazy.
But maybe she was just crazy enough. The farm did well. A few years later, though, Silke died of colon cancer. By then, Daniela had stepped in.
And then I started to learn, and I started to see the importance of what it is we're doing here, which is changing what's happening here in Puerto Rico. We are importing 85% of our food or more.
85%. It's hard to believe, but here on this tropical island, with fertile soils and a year-round growing season, agriculture is virtually non-existent.
But now people are starting to wake up and realize, oh, wait a second, what are we going to eat tomorrow? Or look at all this money I'm spending on groceries. And look at the, can I say crap on radio? Look at the crap we're being fed.
Ironically, not that long ago, Puerto Rico was a mostly rural agricultural society. The classic Puerto Rican archetype was the small farmer, el jíbaro. Then, in 1948, Puerto Rico embarked on an ambitious island-wide industrialization program called Operation Bootstrap. People were plucked out of the countryside and put to work in factories.
There was a cultural change. Agriculture began to be associated with backwardness.
That's journalist Carmelo Ruiz.
Look, we're not farmers anymore. Now we have big factory jobs. Now I go to work in an office. We get our food in the supermarket. And the jíbaro lifestyle, the production of food, became something to be relegated to the museum.
More than that, the word jíbaro itself became an insult. It's like calling somebody a hick.
I mean, it's funny because most Puerto Ricans, including myself, when we think of jíbaro, we have a very classic mental image. Big straw hat, overalls, dirty, barefoot.
But now, Daniela and her fellow eco-farmers are on a mission.
To be a new type of jíbaro, to be a better type of jíbaro, to be a jíbaro that people want to be like.
Maybe one like her, with neon pink skinny jeans, thick framed glasses, and a newborn son in one arm. The new jíbaros are also putting a new twist on the old tradition of sharing work. Today, a dozen people are working together to clear a field with machetes and till the soil.
Back in the day, in the country, people were dependent on their neighbors to survive.
Paul Dill is a member of Boricua, the group that brings these young farmers together.
Sharing knowledge, sharing experience, sharing techniques, giving workshops, trying to create a sense of community in the island.
The unofficial headquarters for that community is El Departamento de la Comida, the Department of Food, where Tara Rodriguez, Daniela's sister, is haggling over star fruit. This isn't some government ministry. It's the place where just about all the organic produce on the island that doesn't go to the farmer's market ends up to be sold to clients. There's also a vegan kitchen.
I have gluten-free tacos with pumpkin, chayote.
Tara thinks farming could help solve some of Puerto Rico's economic woes, like the 30% youth unemployment rate. And she says it's about more than jobs. It can help with health issues, environmental problems, childhood obesity, food security.
I mean, I think here, more than being trendy, and I hope that this is a trend that sticks, the fact that there are so many solutions to big problems in Puerto Rico that people are finding through food will make it stick.
Skeptics might argue that Puerto Rico's eco-farming movement is too small to have much impact on the island. But remember, every big, sturdy tree started out as a little seed. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
And now from clean farming to creating a cleaner community in Los Angeles. Over the last 4 years, hundreds of tons of illegal trash were collected near the busy port of Los Angeles. A lot of it winds up in the community of Wilmington, just south of downtown LA. The number of industrial warehouses and shipping yards there and the lack of streetlights make it easy for just about anyone to dump anything illegally. Molly Collister tells us about one resident who's trying to change that.
In the corner of a vacant lot, a man in dirty beat-up jeans and work gloves swats at a 7-foot-tall weed with a pair of clippers.
The right word for this is a wild tree. They just grew up forever.
Meet Salvador Lara. He's the trash guy. He's a 52-year-old Mexican immigrant who's lived in Wilmington, California for 20 years. For the last 6 years, he's been combing through the streets and alleyways here, sprucing up his neighborhood. Why? Just take a ride in his pickup truck.
Over here, we're getting to an area that always trash tires.
Oh, there, it looks like there's a TV there, too.
Yes, TVs. Building materials, construction materials.
Most of Wilmington has no streetlights or security cameras, so people like contractors sneak over at night and unload their waste instead of paying fees at landfills.
People come over here to dump all kind of, even stolen cars. They bring them over here and they them on fire and just abandon them here. Look, toilets, yeah, doors, look.
Old computer modems, piles of drywall, broken down bookcases, and a lot of plain old garbage.
So when you first started doing this around in your community, what did people think?
I think some people, they thought I was crazy. Some people say, oh, you're paying a ticket. No, I'm not paying a ticket, I'm volunteering.
Lara says it used to discourage him to see trash in areas he had already cleaned up, so he founded Clean Wilmington.
Good morning, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Buenos días. Oh, you brought a helper.
Mary Gutierrez has been volunteering with Lara for about 4 years. She says he makes the effort worthwhile.
He's always smiling, he's always friendly, and he invites everybody to join him, whatever it is that he's doing. So he brings people together.
On a muggy Saturday morning, Lara has gathered half a dozen volunteers from the nearby Valero oil refinery. They're cleaning up a vacant lot just next door. While Lara handles chopping and trimming the overgrown bushes and weeds, his cousin goes around the lot with a weed whacker. The volunteers follow closely behind with rakes and trash bags collecting debris. Daniel Toledo is a Wilmington native. He says littering was accepted when he was growing up, but Clean Wilmington is making people think differently.
I feel that a person can definitely build a stronger relationship, not only with the fellow volunteers, but also feeling a feeling of pride for the city and that they're doing something good for the city itself.
Recently, Salvador Lara was named Man of the Year by the Wilmington Chamber of Commerce. He's been recognized by the Los Angeles City Council and the LAPD. And now, instead of Lara courting volunteers, local businesses and civic groups are recruiting him for cleanup help. His next goal? To get streetlights put up so outsiders can't slip in and dump their trash anymore. For Latino USA, I'm Molly Collister in Wilmington, California.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I've been interested in all different regional differences and aspects of Latin culture for a long time. It's just really a kindred spirit for Eastern European people.
The lead singer of Gogol Bordello on a musical love affair with all things Latino. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Pero ganas no me faltan, güey. Trae a tu abogado y no me jodas con que una a la vez. Me lo han preguntado.
mercado. Y toda vieja que me caiga bien tiene el potencial de ser mi musa. Bueno, cada quien, no me des excusas, tienes una que es estar candente. Y si me usas, que sea intensamente. Y me cuentan, y me dicen, y me observan.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. Undocumented people aren't the only thing at risk in the Southwest.
Cuando vives en la frontera, people walk through you. The wind steals your voice. You're a burra, a scapegoat, forerunner for a new race. You're half and half, both women.
That's Brandy Montaño reading from the book Borderlands, La Frontera. It sounds so impossibly unlikely, but it is true that this book, along with about 90 others, was removed from classrooms in Tucson, Arizona, about 2 years ago, thanks to a law banning ethnic studies courses in state public schools. After a series of court battles and protests, all but 7 books are back on the school shelves. But the anger created by the book banning has given birth to counter-movements. First, there's the Libro Traficante movement, book traffickers. Plus, several underground libraries across the Southwest have sprung up with their shelves stocked with the banned books so that people can read them if they want to. And now in Albuquerque, New Mexico, they've taken the movement one step further by creating a banned book club. Carrie Young has more.
The book ban controversy started about 2 years ago when the Arizona Department of Education did away with all ethnic studies courses in Tucson's public schools, eliminating 90 books. The department claims they were subversive, racially divisive, and encouraged anti-American sentiment. Descriptions Nessa Leal says couldn't be further from the truth.
The books that are banned speak of actual lived experiences. They are not stories that someone just sat down one day and decided to write about the cruelty of a particular race or class.
Leal is the leader of the literacy program at Los Jardines Institute, a community advocacy group in Albuquerque. Arizona's ethnic studies ban gets under his skin. He says the book ban robs young Latino readers and others of the chance to understand where they came from.
And the reality of it is for a lot of people of color and women in our history classes that we're not told the entire story. And that is no accident.
Ban opponents put together a caravan that carried the books to several cities in the Southwest, including Houston and San Antonio. In Albuquerque, Los Jardines cleared out half a room and played host to the library. Not only that, it created a banned books club that meets once a month. Recently, the group celebrated the library's one-year anniversary.
So we just finished setting up all the delicious food for our event tonight. We have some delicious brisket and chicken and salad.
And after a potluck, there's an open mic. Many people read a line or two from their favorite banned book. For Claudia Mitchell, that's 500 years of Chicano women's history.
This book is about Mexicanas that came here and they had to build new traditions of resistance, but not without a sense of the past, so keeping our origins, right?
Mitchell says she grew up in a household that encouraged assimilation rather than honoring her family's Mexican culture. So for her, the books provide a window into her past.
My family was more into, you know, you're American, you should just know English and go to school and, you know, kind of acculturate, assimilate. It took me a long time to figure out, like, maybe there's something deeper in there.
The book club prides itself on its unconventional membership. One of its youngest and most active members is Mitchell's 8-year-old daughter, Bianca.
I like reading, listening to them talk a lot, and sitting down.
Their general approach is also a bit unorthodox. Nessa Leal.
Like, for example, when we read The Next 500 Years, Rethinking Columbus, what we did was we took one of the activities of the book, which is a mock trial of Christopher Columbus.
Leal says the book club has grown organically and is now about 25 members strong.
We're doing all that, not because this can only happen in Arizona.
And speaking of the state that's ground zero for the ban,
I think it's important that not just Latinos and Latinas read these books, but everyone, you know, should have access to these books.
That's Cam Juarez, a newly elected school board member in Tucson, Arizona. He's been a supporter of the underground library movement since its inception. He says the books teach kids critical thinking, and he was pleasantly surprised to hear about Albuquerque's book club.
You go into things with perceptions, and once you experience them, then you have understanding.
In Tucson, there are changes afoot. Juarez, along with two other school board members, recently voted to approve the reintroduction of the last seven banned books into the Tucson curriculum, a move that the Arizona Department of Education isn't thrilled about. Because of what they call prior misuse of the texts, Arizona education officials have promised to closely monitor the reintroduction of the books and pledge to take swift legal action if they find it's breaking the law.
The bridge I must be is the bridge to my own power. I must translate my own fears, mediate my own weaknesses.
We disappear under a night sky with our grandmother moon watching over us, guiding us through the darkness as we walk towards oppression.
Back at Los Jardines, book club members and their supporters are wrapping up their celebration. Next on their reading list, Richard Delgado's Critical Race Theory. For Latino USA, I'm Carrie Young in Albuquerque.
And now, my querido Latino USA listeners, we wanted to close out 2013 with a little music. Gogol Bordello frontman Eugene Hoots grew up in the Ukraine, so you might wonder just what Latin America holds for him. But his new album, Pura Vida Conspiracy, recorded in Mexico, Paraguay, and the U.S., takes wide influences and puts them all in a blender. Cultural and linguistic differences seem to be what drives Gogol Bordello, a band based in what they call Gypsy Punk. We invited Eugene Hoots to join us at NPR's New York studios. He came with a guitar. So, Eugene, take it away with the song Malandrino from your new album.
So alegría. My birth I can hardly remember, but I remember from the start my midwives looking at each other. Wow, this boy is born with singing heart. Old doors for him will fly wide open, for everybody loves a nut. It's true, once they throw me in trenches, frontline amigos sure love that. Da di da 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 do dum, da 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 dum dum. Malandro, malandro, malandrino. Trufalado, trufalo, trufaladino. Malandro, malandro, malandrino. I was born with singing heart. Malandro, malandro, malandrino. Trufaldo, trufaldo, trufaldino. Malandro, malandro, malandrino. I was born with singing heart.
Eugene Hoots, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA. So,
thank you.
You know, that starts as almost a Tex-Mex ballad. That song.
Well,
really,
yeah.
You know, a lot of your longtime fans might not have expected that, but then, you know, of course,
I feel like they would.
You think so?
When is he going to do that?
Because we knew that you were going to get to that high energy part.
Yeah, well, you know, the record was recorded in El Paso for largely, yes. And I've been interested in all different regional differences and aspects of Latin culture for a long time. It's just really a kindred spirit for Eastern European people. It's naturally found its way there.
Can you be a little bit more specific? Because, you know, in terms of Latin American music, you can have tango, samba, corridos.
Yes.
Is it precisely the fact that you can have so much range in terms of Latin American music that makes it kind of work for you?
Well, on the surface, Latin American music is very different from Eastern European. First of all, because you got the ritmo. And Eastern European people have no idea what rhythm is. Latin America is all about groove, whether it's cumbia or whether it's samba or whether it's baile funky. In Eastern Europe, it's primarily the... it's progressively raising to the, you know, to the crescendo and then till you can't get any faster and then dropping on the floor and picking up again.
So, but when you say that in Latin America, it's all about the groove. So what would you play to say, all right, Latin America groove, this is what it sounds like?
One of the main probably things, the unifying things about Latin America right now is cumbia probably.
That is a cumbia coming from Colombia, but it's invaded, really, the whole Latin America. I mean,
in your music, you've done a lot around the issue of being an immigrant, around the stories of migration. You call yourself a citizen of the world. So can you put to words what this whole notion of being a border crosser has meant for you musically and literally physically in terms of what you've ended up producing?
Yeah, it's any migration and any form of cultural interaction is just a form of communication. The planet is an organism, just like the body is an organism. Some countries are like the liver, and some of them are more like the lungs, and some of them are more like, you know, the muscle. And this process of embracing each other's cultures, and immigration is just one of them, that slowly but surely prepares the whole planet for understanding that it's just a one family. It really is.
I'm wondering if there's a particular concert or someone who you met, you know, a story that exemplifies exactly that, which is it's not about the divisions, it's about what we all share that makes us the same.
Even just watching audience every night from the show on Transcontinental Tour, just from their behavior, it's obvious that they're there enjoying each other. You know how people say, like, man, that music just makes me feel free.
So you have a song that you kind of feel captures this sense of your musical self.
Well, yes, there's a song that just deals with exactly with that. And it's called Immigrant Punk. It's a good reason to bring this one up.
Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Upon arriving to the melting pot, I get penciled in as a cat white. Now that I am categorized, officer gets me naturalized. Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. We got an immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Now that I'm living up in God knows where, sometimes it gets hard without a friend. But as I am lurking around, huzzah, I see another immigrant punk. There is a little punk.
So that is clearly making a statement about what you want. What, you know, you don't want to be seen anymore as this alien human being, right? But, you know, you do end up performing, Eugene, in places where probably people don't understand the language that you're saying. And you, by the way, how many languages do you speak?
I don't know. Three, supposedly. But so many licks from all the languages. Spolish, you know. Por favorski, you know.
Oh, I love that. Oh, por favorski. Oh, my gosh. That's like the best.
Spolish is the Gogol Bordello language, number one. That's what we speak in the band.
Give me another example of it. That's amazing.
Actually, Pedro from Ecuador, who's our percussionist and the singer, he is fluent in that language. Yeah.
So when you say that you started going nuts for Latin American music, do you remember what it was? Do you remember where you were and what you were listening to that you said, oh, por Dios, ski?
Yes, that's exactly what I said. It started happening quite naturally when I started DJing in New York City. Have a very juxtaposed style of DJing that not everybody could digest. Consequently, none of it was in English almost. Consequently, people that came were French, Italian, you know, immigrants from, you know, Eastern Europe. And then I realized that about 50% of people on my party were from Latin America, you know, Colombia, Brazil. And they all just kept telling me, it was like a chant, that I got to go down there and figure out for myself, you know, that there was something that is the energy is very same. Like going all the way back to the question you said in the beginning, what's the kindredship? What's the kindredness of it? The energy that's perceived by Europeans and North Americans as chaos is a natural state of being for Latin and Eastern European people. You know, and it's really, it's not, because it's not chaos. It's another form of order where throwing massive celebratory bursts of energy out in the air, you know, and it's a normal kind of a daily thing to do. You know, it's just like
I suddenly have a whole new understanding of my Latina self as a different form of chaos that is a little bit more organized. It helps me a lot, actually, Eugene.
Well, it's nothing to look away from. It's a really beautiful thing. Like, so I felt at home right away when I came to Brazil. I was just like, I'm staying there. A lot of people who come there from Europe or America, they can't deal with it because people are in tropical time. Nobody's running. Nobody's on time. Nobody's, you know, you're lucky if they show up. They'll be like 3 hours late. And people take it so personal, you know, the Europeans, because time is money. It's like, no, I didn't see you today at the lake. I'll see you tomorrow at the beach. Big deal, you know? And that is a kind of a, this is exactly what we have going on in Ukraine. You know, it's like that.
Samba in the Ukraine. So you actually have
It's a lot about partying, too. And partying in the best sense of the word. It's not about being smashed and not knowing where you are. It's just about, like, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, it's just like about that.
About the, I love that, actually. And you were the one who brought up Brazil just now, and on your latest album, you have a song that is very, I don't know, samba-esque. It's called I Just Realized, and yes. I wonder if you would give us a taste.
I would love to. I just realized that I'm dying to see you and hear you all over again and again. When did it start? On which exact moment? Oh, I don't know, and I hope it will end.
Eugene Hutz is the singer and guitarist for Gogol Bordello. Their new album, Pura Vida Conspiracy, is out now, and you can hear full versions of the songs Eugene recorded with us at our website, latinousa.org. That's our program for this week and for the year 2013. Thanks so much for listening, and Feliz Año Nuevo, queridos. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, who leaves us for her next big adventure. Thank you to Carolina for your vision and your passion and your love for Latino USA. We'll miss you. Also, A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, Nancy Trujillo, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Jonathan Wolf and Eva DeLapp. Special thanks to our team at The Futuro Media Group in Harlem, Maria Chaveco, Maya Sanchez Acero, Melanie LaRosa, Gerland Cayo, and for our TV unit, Sandra Ratley, Charlotte Manjin, TTU, Sue Ding, Emily Harold, and Thea Piltzecker. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week in the new year. And until then, we'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Hasta la próxima!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.org. The Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve the lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. And Newman's Own Foundation, giving all profits from Newman's Own to charity and pursuing the common good for over 30 years. This is NPR.